Okay, now we're recording. We're recording with Marshall Murray. Marshall Murray was a state legislator from 1960 to 1964, ran for Attorney General in 1964, and was a delegate to Montana's Constitutional Convention in 1972, and long interested in politics and public affairs. Marshall, what first got you interested in politics?
Well, I became interested in politics probably because of my father's interest. And he was a... And as far as I, as long as I can remember, he was an ardent Republican and believed that people in public office should adhere to the highest of standards, ethically and otherwise, conduct-wise. I can remember him talking about John Bonner as governor, him supporting him even though he was a Republican and John ran as a Democrat.
Now, he knew John in college?
Was I not in? Not then. Oh. No, I was in college. Well, but, I may have been. I may have been.
Your dad knew John Bonner in college. Was that it?
That's yes. My dad was a classmate of John, as I recall, and they were close friends, as I understand it. And so, you know, that familiarity was there, and I understood that situation. Is he bothering you? Got the cord?
Yeah.
Get out of there.
Well, when I heard his skin condition, there you go, okay.
Anyway, I always had an interest, I guess as a result of my father's interest, and he was interested in bar activities, and so community activities. He was chairman of the National Foundation when that started, and was in those types of things, Lions Club. He chartered Libby in Kalispell, so he was always involved in community activities. He chartered the Kegler's Club and all kinds of things. So it was just kind of natural that I was interested in those things. In fact, I can remember stuffing envelopes and looking stamps.
Your dad was a county attorney and elected county attorney.
No. He was elected county attorney of Sanders County while I was still in law school.
Okay.
He couldn't play football his senior year. If he had graduated, they now allow you to do it and go to post-grad classes or something and play a little different game. But in those days, if you graduated, you couldn't play. He wanted to play football his last year, and so he shorted himself a credit that he took in the fall to play football. And as I told you before, he always maintained to me that he was the only candidate for state office that ever campaigned the county in which he was running for office by train. And as you know, Sanders County, in those days the Northern Pacific ran from one end to the other all the way down the river. and Dad went on the train on a trip to California to play football and campaigned it every time the train stopped, or so he said he did anyway. Was elected there. And then that was during the Depression, 32 as I recall, 28. And then he served a few years, then he went up to Eureka and practiced law. And then went down to Libby and was elected county attorney. And then he came over here and formed a partnership with Gordon Rollin in 1940 or 41 when Gordon's partner, Dean King,
became district judge.
Yeah. And then I think my dad served, Gordon was county attorney. And then when Gordon went to the service, my dad served his term out.
Well, then he was county attorney in three different counties.
Three different counties in Montana, yeah. All of Western Montana.
That's quite a story. And he was also president of the Montana Bar Association.
Right? Yes, he was. He served as secretary for a number of years until he became president. And he was, I think, if memory calls and what other people have told me, he was the first small firm, small town president of the Montana Bar Association.
And then you also, weren't you? Weren't you president of the Montana Bar Association?
Yes. Well, I was the first. My dad and all the others, up until my time, were elected at the state convention. And that, of course, was attended primarily by the larger firm lawyers and people who wanted to control the association. And then, while I was a trustee of the Montana Bar Association, we started a movement to go to the mandatory association where all lawyers had to belong to the association. It was just a voluntary thing before. And the election had to be popular. And I am the only president of the Montana Bar who ran for the Bar Association, voluntary association, on a popular statewide vote and was elected.
Wow.
Then the association was terminated. Then the State Bar Association was formed, and then I was the first president of the State Bar Association, also elected on a popular vote statewide.
Well, that's good.
So that's a little history.
When was that? Back in the 60s?
In the 70s.
In the 70s.
Mm-hmm. In the 70s. It was right after I was elected in 75. So my plaque on the wall says 75, 76.
I see.
Although that was the year of my presidency, and I had the wonderful privilege of putting together that association and the committees and selecting the people from the committees and all of that good stuff. I enjoyed that greatly.
But your father was the key, really, I suppose, to you becoming a lawyer and also to you becoming interested in politics, and probably influenced you to be a Republican?
Well, I think absolutely. I don't recall making a decision to be a lawyer. I was just there. That was my educational background in high school and then in college, and some of the teachers that taught me taught my dad. And Dean Liebhardt, who was dean of the law school when I started law school, he then retired kind of during my session there. And he was dean when my dad was in law school. And my dad even lived with him for a while at his house. Yeah.
And his son, I believe, or perhaps his grandson, is a justice on the Supreme Court now?
It's his grandson that is a justice on the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm.
Now, Marshall, did you ever meet Governor Bonner?
Yes, but I didn't meet him when he was governor. I met Governor Bonner when I was serving in the legislature, and he was up doing some lobbying or some type of business, bill drafting or something. I don't recall what it was, but I met him. That at that point in time, I think, is the first time that I met him and got to visit with him at any length.
I remember you mentioning to me sometime that when you were a young boy, you were attending a Bar Association convention with your dad, and your dad placed you in the custody of a couple of guys.
The year of my dad's presidency of the Montana Bar Association, at the annual convention, which was the end of his term, my dad and I went to the convention. In fact, he wasn't feeling very good, and I drove him over there. And when we went into the annual banquet, which was Saturday night in the old hotel uptown, he said to me, "Hey, you guys, take care of the kid." And there were two young, tall, lean, handsome guys standing there, and they took care of me. And I found out afterwards they were John C. Harrison, recently of the Supreme Court of Montana, and the county attorney of Lewis and Clark County for numbers of years, and Mike Mansfield, who then was a congressman. And I was a speaker at that convention. I don't know if I told you, was William O. Douglas of the Supreme Court.
No, really? Yeah.
And I got to meet him. Really? In fact, he had a room in the hotel that was so hot. What Douglas did is dictated a speech before he came out to Montana, and it was to have been mailed to the hotel and available for him for the convention, because he was the keynote speaker at the banquet. And the speech didn't arrive. So he had to cobble one up on his own, and he tried it in his room, and it was so hot he couldn't do it. So he came down to the lobby and found a cool corner. But everybody bothered him, so he couldn't get his speech together. So he came to my dad and said, "What am I going to do?" And Dad says to me, "Get that car and park it someplace in the shade where it's going to be shady for a couple hours." And I did, and then he said, "Take the justice up there." So we put him in our car in the shade in downtown Allen.
Oh, really?
And he wrote his speech.
Oh, really?
Rewrote his speech.
What a story. Now,
and then at that same time, and I have the painting. It's one of the few mementos of my father. J.C. Garlington, who was then incoming president, presented my dad with a picture as an honor of his presidency.
Marshall, would you know about when that was, when that bar convention was, when William O. Douglas was?
It was when I was going into my junior year of high school, which had to be 47, I would think.
Okay, yeah.
47, just about 30 years before my own.
And Douglas would have been a fairly young man then, wouldn't he?
Not to me, he wasn't at the time. But I suppose that that he was in his 60s.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Late 50s, 60s. A vigorous man at that time, as I recall. And a delightful man to be around, as were John C. Harrison and Mike Mansfield.
I'm sure. Now, Bonner was followed in the office of governor by Hugo Aronson. Do you remember anything about that campaign?
I don't remember the campaign.
You remember much about Aronson?
Hugo, well, other than this one thing. I remember that as the campaign was ongoing and got near the end, I became somewhat interested in it because of John Bonner, who my dad had talked about as his friend from college, and Hugo, who my dad began to admire, and from what I could tell was supporting Hugo instead of John. So I asked my dad, "What's the deal? I thought you were pushing for your friend all the time." And he said, "John messed up. He just can't do that and be my governor. Yeah, and we found a guy in the Republican Party who was a pretty good man, and I'm pushing for him and really kind of hope he gets elected. Sorry, John."
And that was the incident down at the governor's convention where he...
In New Orleans.
Made national news.
Where John made national news.
You had that first meeting with Mansfield at that time, just when you were a young guy. Did you ever have any other meeting with Mansfield or any other experience with Mansfield?
I met him several occasions. He was a great friend of my stepmother's, Rose Kirkpatrick Murray, and who ran the Temple Tea Room in Kalispell for a number of years when Mike was in office and active in Montana politics. So I met him there and other places, as I recall. But I think it was before my oldest daughter graduated from high school, when Mike was still the majority leader of the United States Senate, my oldest sister and her husband were living in the Fairfax, Virginia area, just outside of D.C., and he worked at the Pentagon at that point in time and was in the military, and we were going to go back to visit them for about 10 days and tour the area. I wanted my kids to see the government, and I hadn't been there. So it was a fascinating thing to set up, and I, because of Rose and my knowledge of Mike, and I didn't know if he'd know me, but I made arrangements through Mike to visit with him and to go to the White House, and Mike got tickets for us. You had to have some kind of sponsorship in order to get a ticket to go to the White House. When we got to Washington, D.C., and the appointed time that we were to meet with Mike in his office, we went to his office, and Mike was not there. He was on the floor of the Senate. The Senate was in the chambers. But he left word to go to the Senate. So we went over to the Senate, and the Secretary of the Senate, Stanley Kimmett, met us, and I introduced myself and said we were to come over to see the Majority Leader. Who's a senator from Montana, where we're from. "Oh, you must be the Murray family." "Yes, yes." And so he went in and got Mike. Mike came out and visited with the family for about 45 minutes.
Wow.
In the ante room while the Senate was going on.
He probably remembered your dad and probably remembered Rose.
We talked about all those things.
Yeah. He was absolutely phenomenal. Ability to remember people.
He remembered that I ran against Forrest Anderson for Attorney General, and Alex, at the same time Alex Blewett ran against Mike for the United States Senate.
Yeah.
And Lyndon Johnson, of course, swept Montana, and everybody swept with him.
Did you ever meet Senator Metcalf?
Well, I believe I met him, but I didn't know him, and I know that he didn't know me. We just were in different circles, and Metcalf was primarily an environmentalist, and it just wasn't the circle that I was in.
How about Congressman Arnold Olson and Attorney General Arnold Olson?
I met Arnold Olson at that same convention where I met Mike Mansfield and William O. Douglas, and Arnold then, and I don't know that he was Attorney General. I think he was campaigning for his first term, and met him in the lobby of the hotel. My dad introduced me to him, and then, of course, I met Arnold any number of times after that. And in the 64 campaign, he was running for Congress, I believe, at that point in time, and we were on opposing podiums a time or two, and Arnold was. I met him when he came back and became judge.
Yeah.
I met him several times that time, particularly at one bar convention in Great Falls where we had nice visits.
And how did you find him?
You know, Bob, I have to say this in all candor, regardless of political party, I have found all of the people that I've named and others that we haven't discussed that have earned their way through the political process to higher office, all of them have always treated me very well. I have never had a personal problem with any of them. I think that I personally really respect people who run for public office. I don't think you can achieve the opportunity to run for high office without being a nice person, especially in Montana. I don't think you can cover anything up.
Well, I had a similarly good experience with Arnold Olson. He was very kind to me when I was a young person back in Washington, D.C.
Well, in fact, when I ran for Attorney General, the kindest person to me in both political parties was Congressman John Melcher. And John took me around eastern Montana in his swings by himself when I was looking for the opportunity to gather some votes, and took me several places. And
this was
very kind to me.
Before you had filed for Attorney General?
No, this is one after I had filed.
Really?
John was running for re-election against Bob Kelleher, as I recall.
I wonder if Forrest Anderson never knew about that.
I don't think John Melcher cared, one way or another. He was I'd served with him in the legislature, so I knew John Melcher.
Sure, yeah.
But I think he was in the Senate when I was in the House, but we knew each other. And he was just a really nice guy, and he said, come on, you know, I'll give you a ride. I'll take you here and there. And so he did. We, you know, when we get to town, we separated, so we weren't together, naturally.
Oh, I see. Yeah,
but,
sure.
He was kind enough to do that, and I was deeply appreciative.
Now, you first ran for the state legislature in 1960, and maybe you can explain a little bit about what led to that decision to run for the legislature, maybe what the issues were. And
when I graduated from law school, I worked for an insurance company for a while, and after about 18 months, I went into private practice in Missoula, and within a few months became a deputy county attorney working for Anthony Kiest. But I had already established my political credentials as a Republican, and Tony caught a little hell about that, but he didn't care because I was a classmate and did the job.
Tony Kiest was the Democrat county attorney in Missoula County?
Yes.
Didn't he later run for public office as a Republican?
No.
Okay.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think Tony got in trouble.
Okay.
I think he got out of public office.
Okay, all right.
He was put out of public office, but I don't remember if he got beat or he didn't run because of
his trouble.
But anyway, while it kind of became known that, and I don't know whether it was through JC organization or what organization, that I was a Republican, and I was solicited by several of the Republicans who weren't very happy about the Republican hierarchy in Missoula. They weren't doing anything, and Democrats were controlling all the offices everywhere. And so we formed a group called the Missoula County Republican Club, and were successful in the next legislative session, quite successful. And then I came back to Kalispell in 59, and we were the same way up here. Fred Broder was the only Republican serving, as I recall, in either House or Senate. And Matt Himsel was the party chairman, and Matt was terrific, but Matt was running a garage, and things weren't going well. Matt didn't think that he needed any help, but Dean Jellison, who was then, I think he was then county attorney, and Roger Baldwin, with whom he practiced, the son of another Republican, Charlie Baldwin, who was prominent in Kalispell politics for a number of years, but was then dead. And I decided that we got to do something about this. So we formed a Missoula, or Flathead County Republican Club, and went out and got a bunch of people. And then we decided that, one of the things we learned in Missoula is that you had to have better candidates than the Democrats had. Didn't care if they were prominent people and rode hard in the community and had paid their dues, they had a better chance to be elected, regardless of what their party was, than somebody that didn't. I mean, you needed, it's like Anthony Robinson, you got to have the edge. You got to get the edge. So we went out and solicited people to run who were prominent in the valley, and Sterling Rigg and Con Lundgren and with Fred, and we couldn't find the fourth to run. We wanted to run as a team, as a slate, couldn't find the fourth. So it came down to who's going to do it, and I got the short straw. No intention of running whatsoever. Just started to practice, and you know, in Kalispell, it was a sacrifice. But anyway, I did, and we had a very tough campaign against McGarvey, Sheldon, and Tonner, and prevailed.
And do you remember there were a couple of issues, weren't there? There was a particular approach?
There were a couple of issues. You mentioned one the last time we interviewed about the public utility districts. It was a private versus public power issue was one. Private versus public power, yeah. And that was the public utility district type thing. The state of Washington had some success with that. And of course, we were all private power owned in Montana, except for a very small utility here and Eureka and Missoula.
Some rural electric co-ops.
Electric co-ops. That was one issue, but the underlying issue was spending and taxing, and we just felt that those people they were really good at taxing and spending. I guess we didn't think so badly about the taxation, although we think it was a business killer, an economy killer, to some extent, but the difference in philosophy was that the Democrats just felt if they threw money at a problem, it was going to solve it, and it never did solve it. It created more because you taxed people more and you never solved the problem. And so we went down there with an idea that we could do a better job of getting more bang for the buck. Welfare was out of hand. Workers' comp was out of hand. There were several issues that were really, I mean, at that point in time, I think Flathead County was known statewide as the most liberal welfare county, and people were coming in all over the nation. Yeah, we, you know, just things need to be done statewide in order to solve that problem a little bit, and so we tried to do it.
And you were all successful. It was a Republican sweep.
Mm-hmm. It was a Republican sweep, except for George Siderius, who was there.
Yeah, he was a holdover.
He was a holdover.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so then your first session was 1961.
61.
Mm-hmm. And who was the governor?
Governor at that time was Don Nutter.
And what are your recollections of him?
Fond recollections. I just really, really respected the man. I knew him when I was still in law school, and he was in the Senate from Sydney Glendive area. And I remember the law professors almost genuflecting when Don Nutter, who was a mature man at that point in time and was a successful businessman in that area, had decided to go back to law school. It was after that he got into politics. So I met him at law school, but then I got to know him real well because he spent a lot of time in the Flathead during his campaign for governor.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's when I got to know him, and then when he got to be governor, he sort of took me under his wing a little bit, and we had several conversations.
Describe him. I've heard him described as outspoken, dynamic, strong, decisive.
He was a big man going toward being heavy set, but strong physically, strong voice. I recall him being humble but determined. He knew where he was going. He set an agenda and he was going to achieve it. He knew how to set goals. He knew how to analyze things better than anybody I'd seen at that point in time. He was able to resolve issues better than most people that I'd seen. He didn't have to agonize over things. He had an analytical mind, and it would come to him in options, and he would narrow them down. And he says, usually, there really isn't. There's only one that's doable anyway.
Uh-huh.
He said, the tough time is when there are two that are doable. Then you have to look to maybe some other direction to see which way you should go.
But, and he told you that?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Do you remember ever visiting with him in his office when he was governor?
I remember visiting him in his ante room when he was governor, the governor's conference room, because we had a Republican caucus down there, and he came in and told us what he wanted to do for the university system regarding funding, and five of us stood up and said, no, we're not going to do it. And he was a little alarmed by it, but he was the type of a man who, and we proved to win out in the long run, because I think it was the right cause at the right time. And but he never held anything against you.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he made an exceptional governor. I thought he was good governor, but he never lived long enough in the office to establish any legacy.
He was killed in a plane crash in, I think, January of 1962. He'd only been governor for about a year.
Right.
And then he was replaced by Tim Babcock.
Tim Babcock.
And so your second session in the legislature, Babcock was governor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Did you have any experiences with him?
Other than as a legislator with the governor, those things, nothing special, although Tim did solicit me to run for Attorney General.
I see.
And I did.
And tell me about that, your campaign for Attorney General.
Although I'm a Republican, and I have strong feelings about taxing and spending and some other issues, I would put myself in rather a conservative evangelical side of the party. I think that I'm pretty much middle road. I do believe in a strong environmental situation, although not to the extent some do, as far as killing the economy of the state or preserving coal for no reason that I can ever remember, and still don't. I forget what point I'm getting.
Well, I'm just asking you about your motivation to run for Attorney General.
Oh, you know, and people asked me, wanted me to run. They didn't have a candidate. And one of the reasons that I ran was because I now knew after the second session and what it was doing to my law practice that economically it was building business, but I wasn't there to take care of it, that I had to either get in politics or out from a candidate standpoint.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, I'll give a go. But when I ran, being a moderate, I thought Nelson Rockefeller was going to be the Republican National candidate for president, and turned out he didn't end up that way, and it had to be Barry Goldwater, and that made a very interesting campaign in Montana, because you had the Goldwater Democrats were evangelical, and they,
the Goldwater Republicans.
Oh, Republicans, yeah. I mean, it was difficult. You almost had to genuflect to Goldwater in some areas of eastern Montana, or they'd vote against you,
yeah,
for no particular reason. Yeah. It was a tough year. I liked Barry Goldwater personally. I met him in Great Falls, stood on the stage with him. I liked what he said and what he believed, but there were those who supported him who made that their total cause for a living. It didn't work out very well as far as
voting. Had Rockefeller been the nominee, there's at least the possibility that we would have had more strength at the top of the ticket. And
because that was my view.
And you were swimming against the tide a little bit, right, in
1964. Right. Of course we were, because of Kennedy's assassination, yeah, and Lyndon Johnson being in the civil rights movement. It was a tough year to run for office anyway, but with a Goldwater versus Johnson and the civil rights movement and Kennedy's assassination, all of that, you were defeated before you started with the Goldwater candidate.
And you were running against an incumbent.
Running against Forrest Anderson, who was Attorney General at that point in time. And was probably a good Attorney General, except he was a part-time Attorney General. There was no requirement that the Attorney General serve full-time. He had a law office uptown with a wonderful fellow by the name of Mickey Chilton, later became a priest and served in Eureka. And if you wanted to get something done in the Attorney General's office, you had to retain Mickey. And that sort of was the way to did it. And I thought it was appallingly wrong. Yeah. I just did not think that's... Now, it's kind of like my dad. I think you got to do the right thing. If you're a public officer, you shouldn't be there. And so that was a cause that I took on.
And as I recall, you came close, too, didn't you? I mean, it wasn't a landslide.
Depends on what a landslide is anymore. We didn't. Sonny Almhot was reelected substantially, but I don't even recall.
And Babcock made it.
And Tim Babcock made it, but they were both incumbents.
Yeah.
Ted James, I think, made lieutenant governor. But that kind of came about through the fact that he married former Governor Ford's daughter, and there was an influence there. Yeah. The gubernatorial ticket, but outside Omaha, nobody else got elected.
Also, I think Scotty James, Ted James's brother, I believe, was the editor of the Great Falls Trib.
That helped too.
So that might have helped too.
I think that helped too. Yeah, it did, certainly.
And so then, when you weren't successful running for Attorney General in 1964, you came back to the Flathead Valley and devoted more time to your law practice?
Yes, right. When I was, during the two legislative sessions and also during my campaign for Attorney General, I was the city attorney of Kalispell besides being in private practice.
Okay.
And served under Tom Flynn for 6 years, and Mayor Bjornaby won. I started in 61, so that ran until 68. So during all that time, they were kind enough to allow me to do those things.
So you were a legislator, city attorney, and trying to establish a private practice all at the same time?
All at the same time.
Wow, wow. Now, as a legislator, were there other legislators that stood out in your memory?
Mm-hmm.
People that you have a special recollection of?
Jerome Anderson was majority leader in the 61 session. Of course, Fred Broder was outstanding in my mind because he kept me under his wing and taught me how things went. He gave me a learning process that I don't think with term limits these people even have. And I couldn't have picked it up on my own in 5 or 6 sessions probably what Fred told me in 30 days
yeah.
or taught me in 30 days. Tom Judge was there.
Who later became governor.
And later became governor. Ted Schwinden was there serving. He later became governor. There were several outstanding people, but those two probably rose higher than anybody else. There, Kermit Daniels was an assistant floor leader, as I recall, of
on the 61
session Democrat side. Well, all those, Schwinden and Judge were both.
Now Marshall, my impression of Tom Judge and Ted Schwinden is somewhat different. I think of them as having quite different personalities, but I didn't serve with them in the legislature like you did, especially, I mean, in the same session.
Both of my sessions, 61 and 63, the Republicans were in the majority of the
yeah.
House. Ted Schwinden, as I recall, was the minority floor leader in the 61 session. I don't think he served in 63. In the 61 session, he was the mean mouthpiece for the Democrats, and he was tough and rigid and unfriendly. Tom Judge, always from day one, knew that he would be governor someday, and I think every move that he ever made was toward that goal. So Tom was friendly and industrious and accommodating when he could be without getting out of line and all of those things. Ted was different. Ted was at the pinnacle of his political career until he became governor.
Yeah.
And he ruled his roost.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Jim Lucas, was he there then?
In 63, Jim Lucas came to the legislature. And then in 63, Frank Hazel Baker became the speaker. And Alex Blewett, one of the great lawyers in Montana history, became the majority leader, and that's the same Alex Blewett that ran against Mike Mansfield for the United States Senate in 64. Alex was one of the great trial lawyers in Montana history from a defense standpoint, which is and a very close person to me. I admired him.
What do you remember, Marshall? The first legislator that you mentioned when I asked you about memorable legislators was Jerome Anderson, who was majority leader, I think, in 61 or 62.
Jerry Anderson was a lawyer from Billings.
Any specific memories? Or
he just did a great, of course, my first session, so I really had not paid much attention to how the legislature ran. I felt that he did a wonderful job of running the House at that point in time. Clyde Hawks was the speaker, but as you know, sometimes the speakers are strong and run the House, and sometimes the speakers are secondary and the majority leader runs the House. I would say that during Jerry Anderson's, during the 61 session, that had to be equal, or Jerry was the stronger. First of all, he had a bigger political base, being from Billings, mm-hmm. and was a lawyer. Clyde was a rancher from out of Billings, some places, mm-hmm. I recall. When Frank Hazelbaker was Speaker in 63 with Blewett as the majority leader, served closely by Jim Hoy from Billings, another prominent lawyer in Montana history, big in the oil and gas world. When they were there, that was very much a partnership. Frank never really tried to rule the roost or direct things. It was a committee that ran it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fun to be a part of that leadership in 63 because they took me as a young lawyer from Kalispell and involved me in lots of discussions that I probably wouldn't have gotten a chance to be in for 10 or 15 years if I just normally served my term.
Any Democrats? Bardineau?
Francis Bardineau was there. Was a wonderful guy. As I recall, he had a hair lip handicap. Mumbled about half the time, but his heart was really, he was really a hard-working, red bills, knowledgeable person. And I should have mentioned him as an outstanding one, because from their standpoint, from the Democrat standpoint, in my opinion, he probably was the most evenly balanced, dedicated, forward-looking representative that there was.
Now, Marshall, during that period when you were there, the Anaconda Company was, I think, an important influence in Montana politics. At least most historians who write about the political history of Montana, probably from at least World War I, or maybe even earlier than that, the mining industry, had great influence in the politics of our state. And so I guess probably people might differ a little bit about this, but historians seem to be pretty much of the same mind that the Anaconda Company had a powerful influence in Montana politics, at least up into the 1960s. It may have been on the wane a little bit when you were there. Any thoughts or impressions about that?
As a young man and going through law school and starting out in business and practice, I think everybody was aware of the fact that there were those in Montana who claimed the Anaconda Company in Montana, Power Company, and the State Chamber of Commerce were of great influence. And they may well have been. But from my personal standpoint, in my service, in 61 and 63, and my candidacy in 64, and later my service as president of the Montana Bar Association, I just didn't observe that great influence. Now, they were in 61 and 63, when we still had lobby rooms where you could go and have a drink or a sandwich or whatever you had.
Hosted hospitality rooms. I think they called them watering holes. Was kind of their nickname.
Right. Yeah. In 61, as I recall, we had the petroleum industry had a room, and the Anaconda Company had a room, and there may have been some others. Those I remember. In 63, because green stamps had been voted out in Montana, the green and gold stamp industry had a lobby room as well. So there were two lobby rooms in Jorgensen's where I lived in 63. The petroleum one by Basil Andacopoulos was the lead lobbyist for them. And the stamp room in which Jerome Anderson, who had been majority leader in 61, was with John Cavan, also an attorney from Billings and a wonderful guy. They ran the stamp room. Uptown, the Anaconda Company, as I understood it, had done this for years, had a room in the old hotel.
Old Placer Hotel.
Old Placer Hotel, about the sixth floor or something. I was only there a few times, but where they always had some prime rib or something going with the refreshments of some kind, whatever you wanted. And so that anybody who needed a sandwich or a dinner or something at the end of the session and wasn't taken out by a lobbyist or go someplace, had an event, had a place to go. And it was a, you know, all three of the places where you could sit and wind down. I thought, and of course they were there to keep their presence. I don't recall more than a few times in both sessions ever really being hustled by anybody to really vote for something or for or against. Those people, the people that they had as lobbyists were very skilled people, and they would befriend you, and they would be nice to you, and usually they didn't even have to ask, and usually the issues, well, there weren't so damn many bills as there are now, the issues were clear, and you knew pretty much where you were, and if you were of my philosophy, then there weren't too many decisions to make because they wouldn't be trying to influence me particularly because I would be thinking predominantly along the lines of their interests. Now there were others that they probably worked on, but I can't tell you that. I did not believe that the Anaconda Company at that point in time, 61 and 63, had the influence the Montana Power Company did.
I see.
I think that it may have been winding down, and mm-hmm. I've heard J. Ross Toole and others vehemently attack the Anaconda Company and its practices and its newspapers on and on about the great influences and decisions of Montana history. And I say, well, that may very well be, but where was I? Because I didn't see it.
In the when you were there, you got the impression perhaps the Montana Power Company cast a little larger shadow?
I think so, because the Anaconda Company played both sides of the aisle, Democrats and Republicans. Their interests were not primarily one or the other. Their interests were 63 had the influence the Montana Power Company did.
I see.
I think that it may have been winding down, and mm-hmm. I've heard J. Ross Toole and others vehemently attack the Anaconda Company and its practices and its newspapers on and on about the great influences and decisions of Montana history. And I say, well, that may very well be, but where was I? Because I didn't see it.
In the when you were there, you got the impression perhaps the Montana Power Company cast a little larger shadow?
I think so, because the Anaconda Company played both sides of the aisle, Democrats and Republicans. Their interests were not primarily one or the other. Their interests were their economic interests of their company, and some of those crossed party lines, and they had Democrat and Republican lobbyists. The Montana Power Company on the other side, with the Republicans in control of the House, with a substantial majority, both in 61 and 63, they had not one lobbyist for a Republican side and one for the Democrats. They had a series of lobbyists all the time. And they were more influential in the state chamber of commerce, so they really could attack, and Stock Growers Association, various things. The chief lobbyist for the Montana Power Company was an attorney from Butte by the name of Bob Corrett, whose brother ran the company. Jack ran the company. Both were lawyers, and both had the Corrett Law Firm in Butte, who got their great success from trying lawsuits successfully as kids, and then the Union Pacific came in and gave them a whopping retirement, and they represented, or a whopping retainer, represented the Union Pacific, was the key to their success in their law practice. But when Jack went to the power company as president from the law firm, then of course he kept the firm as his political arm, and Anaconda didn't have the ability to have anybody outside of Butte in Montana officing. But the Montana Power Company, through both its electrical and particularly its gas, had representatives in every community that they were in, and they always had somebody that was a really nice person. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're people in politics on all sides are, you know, they understand nice people.
But the Anaconda Company had their presence was largely in Butte.
Butte, East Helena, and Great Falls.
Okay, and Great Falls.
But Great Falls was almost probably done by that time, as I recall.
But what you're saying is
Anaconda.
The Montana Power Company, of course, provided service, electrical power service.
Virtually over a great majority of Montana.
And so they had a manager or a presence in almost every community.
Almost every community. Like a mail service or a teacher, you know.
Sure.
They had somebody out there who was talking to the people and servicing and visiting.
Part of their company policy was to be involved in the community and to take an interest and know your legislator and that sort of thing.
They weren't there if they didn't. I can tell you that. And they were very effective in a low-key way. So you didn't have to get any pressure on you from the lobbyists. If they felt that you needed a little pressure, they could get it from your county or your city where we represented by just calling home and say, you know, get on the phone or write a little letter or do something. You know, get some influence.
Yeah.
And so they were very effective. Anaconda, of course, sold out and left Montana. It has no presence within a few years after my little political career of 4 or 5 years. And the Montana Power Company made a decision, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago now, I guess, where they would get out of the transmission system and production system and get into telephones or some damn thing and blew it.
Yeah. It seems hard to believe, doesn't it, that the Anaconda Company and the Montana Power Company, who were such a prominent part of our state, are both gone now. And it happened relatively suddenly and even somewhat unexpectedly.
And all of that great influence they once had isn't missed either, nor have things changed.
Not much, really, I guess.
So, you know, from my standpoint, looking back, and I'm not lecturing to university students or trying to make a career selling books against either of them, I think they played their roles very effectively at their time for their own economic interests. I don't think that they were trying to ruin Montana.
Well, they had a meeting.
They wanted the government to run.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody in business wants government to run. They'd like to have it run a little better their way than the other way. Because we know there are no governments failed. No governments don't fail under our system. We've had a parliamentary system, sometimes they fail, but they don't fail under our system. In my career, sometimes they run a little better with certain hands on the controls than they do other times, but they always seem to run.
I want to ask you about your experience as a delegate to the 1972 Montana Constitutional Convention. And of course, you were the floor leader at the convention and chairman of the Rules Committee and played a major role. But before we do that, maybe just share with me briefly your philosophy. We've talked about the fact that that your dad was instrumental in making you interested in public service and that your dad was a Republican. He respected him very much. Mm-hmm. And if you could define your philosophy, if you could define maybe I could ask you this question in two ways: how Republicans during your lifetime generally think and believe, what the Republican philosophy is, and maybe kind of just describe your own philosophy in a general way. People 50 years from now may be listening to this interview. And so
they'll wonder what kind of a guy this was.
And they'll be wondering what kind of, you know, what were Republicans
My philosophy was, I think it still is, relatively simple. I believe that we need a government to do those things that the people collectively need to have done that can't be served by private interests. Private business or private interest. I believe that if there are areas that can be served better by private industry rather than government, that there shouldn't be governmental interference. I believe in individual rights, freedom. I believe in a clean environment. I think that we should not tax to the point where it harms the individuals in their freedoms and in their dealings, and that when we do, we ought to spend that money well. And I think that just about sums it up.
Good. Good. I think it's a good description. In 1972, Montana elected a delegates to a state constitutional convention. Our 1889 constitution was being criticized to some extent, and there was a feeling that we needed a new constitution. Were you aware of any of those criticisms of the 1889 constitution?
Sure.
What were some of the problems?
If there was a time when the major interests in Montana, and when I say that major political interests, and by that I mean not only Anaconda, Montana Power, Montana Chamber of Commerce, local chambers of commerce, Stock Growers Association, Cattlemen's Association, Grain Growers, all of those tavern owners, all of those people that have vested interests and are all over. There are also various interests in labor was huge. And the coalition between labor and the farmers' union, second strongest, maybe in close to being first. I don't know, might be even be equal at that point in time. You had one farm group, farm bureau type group, that was conservative, and then you had the farmers' union that was. They were co-op, public power, everything public. They were big government. They just, their firm belief, I think, was that more of a socialistic stand than a private stand and various things, and they didn't care how big government got. They thought government should run it because they could run it well, and I was opposed to some of that. But at any rate, there were those interests, and what was the point I was going to make? Ask me your question again.
There was an increasing feeling that the 1889 Constitution needed something.
Oh, these people, these people who had those groups were very adept at keeping the legislature and the government, administrative, executive branches, well within the purview of the Constitution, which had hundreds of restrictions. And they just were able to manipulate that, knowing it, because they were skilled at playing the game. There were those who wanted to do things in Montana, and if you wanted to do something different or change direction, you always had a hurdle constitutionally to overcome. And our Constitution was about as far from our federal Constitution as you could have one in terms of format and simplicity and the division of the government areas.
The 1889 Constitution was a kind of a complicated, maybe,
terribly complicated.
Detailed document?
Very detailed, very complicated. If you wanted to find out if you could do something, you almost had to start with the Constitution rather than the statutes. you just had to go back and do your research that direction. And it allowed vested interests to be able to play a judicial game, plus an administrative, plus a legislative game that those less experienced couldn't play as well. So they had a leg up. Then it became came a time in about 68 or 70 when the people in the legislature decided that we ought to have a new convention because you couldn't really amend it, not as broadly as it needed to be amended to become more like a federal constitution or like some of the states that by that point in time had some conventions had put their documents together more simplistically, broader,
mm-hmm.
and not so restrictive. So the government had a chance to operate within the framework without vested interest taking advantage. And that movement to have a constitutional convention was bitterly opposed by certain groups that I've mentioned, and they lost. And
basically, the state business community was.
I think it was the business community. That's my recollection.
So that might include the Chamber of Commerce, the Anaconda Company, the Montana Power Company, the Railroad Association.
And if not directly, certainly that was the underlying opposition. they play that very carefully, so I don't know what you can find in the media, but it's my understanding they certainly did.
Yeah.
And they didn't want the convention because they didn't know what might happen. But they decided to have the convention, and they set up the apparatus for the convention.
The legislature voted to have the convention.
Yes, yeah. As I recall. Yeah. They set up the apparatus, they set up a commission, they said Alex Blewett, who served as majority leader when I was in the House in 63 and ran against Mike Mansfield the Senate, was selected to be chairman of that commission. And they created the whole thing that was the starting point of the convention itself. And then then the people who were instrumental in setting up and getting the legislature to adopt and have a convention and setting up the apparatus for the convention wanted to run, and there was litigation involved at that point in time to keep them from running. And that litigation, the people who opposed the current legislators from running won. So all the people that were involved in the movement to set it up and had set up the commission couldn't run.
Was that based on some idea of like a conflict of interest or something?
I don't remember it was done,
yeah.
But the reason it was done was to kill the momentum for a convention.
Oh, I see.
If you didn't have those people that were the spearheading the whole cause there and they couldn't serve, you had a leg up or an opportunity to control the convention better.
Okay.
And it almost worked. But, you know, they elected
100
delegates.
So no sitting legislator could run for delegate?
None.
And that was a court decision?
Yes, as I recall.
Yeah, okay. And so you had been a legislator?
Yes.
But you weren't at that time?
Yes.
So it was possible for you to run? And was that, maybe some of your thinking was that you might be able to use some of your experience as a legislator to...
I never even thought about it in that fashion. I just thought that maybe there was something I had to offer, a gift I might have of some kind. I don't know why, but it interested me. And political science and history was what I had started before I went into law school, and it had always been a major interest through my dad, and I just...
You had a working knowledge of the Constitution, having been a lawyer.
Yeah, and a lawyer, yeah, right, and city attorney, where that's what was involved, and a legislator, you know, all those things. So I just wanted the opportunity, once again, when I had some influence in helping to select a group of candidates to run. Thinking back to my initial thought when we formed the Missoula County Republican Club and the Flathead County Republican Club, that if you were going to do the right job, you had to have the right people as your candidates in order to do that. And once again, I got kind of pushed into it. But I had an interest this time. When I ran for the legislature, I just had an interest politically to change what was there.
Uh-huh.
This time I had an interest because I felt I might lend something.
And what a wonderful way to be involved, you know,
oh,
to
boy.
Write the Constitution of your state. What a unique opportunity.
Oh, it was unique. You know, when the Democrats were the majority, we ran on a partisan basis, and the Democrats had control. And so they were going to have control, but the way it worked out, the decision led by Leo Graybill, who was a Democrat and an ardent Democrat, liberal Democrat all his life.
And he was elected president of the Constitutional Convention?
He was elected president of the Constitutional Convention.
By the Democrats or by all the delegates?
Well, he was proposed by the Democrat group. He knew in terms of numbers,
right,
that he was going to be the president.
Yeah.
Everybody knew that.
Yeah.
And although we didn't caucus really as uh-huh. such, they sort of did. The Republicans never...
Now, hadn't he been Speaker of the House?
I don't know.
He'd had some...
He ran for the legislature. He may have been in the legislature, but he ran for Congress.
Yeah.
His dad had some political influence before
him. Yeah, his dad may have been Speaker of the House, too. I'm not sure about that.
I think it might have been his dad.
Yeah, but he had a big presence, and so it was pretty much for sure that he was going to be...
He was a well-respected labor lawyer, and you know, and I think he'd had... You know, he knew what the system was.
So it seems like someone like him might have been... terrifying to most Republicans. What did he do that
Well, what he did is made sure that a Republican got to be vice chairman, vice president of the convention,
John Toole,
from Missoula County. And so he immediately engineered things so that Republicans would be involved. He came up with the decision to seat us alphabetically.
So there wasn't a Republican side of the aisle and a Democrat side.
That's right. And that was a major thing, the way he seated there. And then when he got elected, the Republicans had somehow tried to get me to lead a caucus, and I didn't have any interest in it particularly.
So maybe the Republicans kind of felt that you might be kind of their leader in the partisan kind of situation?
And I think that they tried to get me to do that, but there was a reluctance among the Republicans to caucus and to be in opposition, because I think all of us, regardless of political affiliation, were elected to do a job and felt that we needed to pretty much meld together in order to do that. And then Leo, and I don't know what his motivation was, whether it was the fact that he saw that they were trying to get me to be a leader, or and he wanted to quell that, or whether he respected my ability as a legislator and lawyer, but he came to me and said, "Now, I want to let you know how we're going to run this thing. The committees are going to be chaired alternately by Democrats and Republicans. And where the Democrat is in charge, chairman of a committee, there will be a Republican as a vice chairman, and vice versa, all the way through." And he named those people. And then he said, "And of course, you're going to be chairman of rules. Then you're going to have a vice chairman that's a Democrat." I said, "Well, you know, what is this rules committee thing?" You know? And he explained to me, he said, "You know, we hadn't had a convention since 1989 or something like
1889.
And we don't know how to do this, and you've got as much skill as anybody. So I'm going to name you the rules committee chairman. You got to run the convention. All the issues, all the legal issues, all the disputes under rules, everything. You have to handle those things in your committee."
And in addition to that, you had to make the procedural motions on the floor, didn't you?
Right. Yeah. Well, to some extent, but that worked a great deal differently than the legislature.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, because the committee chairman.
Okay.
I mean, there were function and administrative rules of the operation of the convention that I was involved in always, but when the committees reported, the committee chairman of that respective committee or the vice chairman would lead, would make the motions, and somebody would second the motions, and then the debate would take place.
Yeah.
So it really didn't operate quite the same as a partisan situation.
Okay.
But anyway, he said, "You do that," and I said, "Well, okay, if that's the call you want to make, why?" As long as we're seated in an alphabetical basis, and as long as the Republicans have half the representation on all the committee chairmanships, as long as John Toole is vice president of the convention, then I'll be more than happy to do that. And so I did. And then he said, "Well, thank you." And I said, "Well, where are the rules we're going to operate on? I better get familiar with those rules." And he said, "You have until January 1 to come up with a set." "What do you mean?" He says, "You got to draft them. You got to submit them to the convention. You're the first thing out of the chute with a set of rules." So he said, Rick Applegate was one of the staff members for the commission and was assigned to the Bill of Rights Committee, and they'd also assigned him to get us several sets of rules. So I went to him, and we got several sets of rules, and I said,
"But were from other constitutional conventions that
other
occurred?
Legislatures and constitutional conventions that had adopted recent rules."
I see.
And I took those home, and you know, my committee's all over Montana, and I didn't have a chance to work it out with the committee. So I sat down and drafted what I thought was an appropriate set of rules for this convention under the format that we were going to operate, on a nonpartisan basis, so to speak. But I wanted it, as opposed to the legislative rules, I wanted it to be very open. I wanted as much citizen participation and knowledge of what we were doing as possible. So I drafted what, in terms from my conservative background, probably is about as opposite set of rules as you'd have, a very open set of rules using several of the key points of the areas that had had success from citizen participation and were successful using the rules. And so I put together a set of rules which were adopted almost verbatim.
Wow.
It was fun to do that.
And then
doing that, of course, I had no difficulty running the rules committee whenever a question was there, because I knew those rules pretty well.
And I suppose there were times when the convention had to recess so that you could clarify a rule.
No.
Or they didn't have.
This group of people was different. This group of people was a unique group of people, all 100 people in their own way. Their motivation was to draft a new constitution for the state of Montana. And we were, the way we operated, we really didn't have to call a recess and have a ruling. We would defer that issue until the committee could meet and rule.
I see.
So early in the convention, most of the work was done in committees. And once in a while, there'd be an administrative flap. But generally, Leo was able to put that off and do, I'll assign that to the rules committee, is what he would say. And they'll come back with the ruling. What's the next line of business, you know?
Yeah.
And we'd get on with, no, we didn't stop. We didn't, I don't recall once.
And you say that
bringing the convention to a halt for a ruling.
And the rules were, you tailored the rules to make the convention as open as possible.
Yes.
And so were there, then if you had the different committees, I think the education article was written by a committee, and the environmental part was written by a committee, and the different parts of the Constitution. So did those committees function like legislative committees, in the sense that people came before them and made testimony? And
what happened was that when the commission set up the various committees, it broke it all down before the convention was ever started. When it did that, it assigned research assistants to each of those committees. And they made a book, a study commission book, about various things. And, my primary committee was Bill of Rights, so they broke down every subject that we've had in the Bill of Rights and gave us pros and cons of what other states had done, where we were, and what the...
Well, so you also served on the Bill of Rights Committee in addition to being the chair of the Rules Committee.
Right. Uh-huh. And so we had all that work up done for us. Then what we did was, as a convention, similar to the legislative process, each delegate could submit proposals. Those proposals for suggestions in the Constitution were assigned by the President to the appropriate committee, whether it be Revenue Committee or Bill of Rights Committee or Judiciary Committee or Education or whatever. Those the delegates submitted everything.
So you might be a delegate and you might think, gee, I have an idea for a concept that pertains to revenue and taxation. I'm not exactly sure how it's worded, but I want the committee to at least consider this, so it would be
you'd rough something out.
Yeah, rough something out.
And you'd submit it as a delegate proposal. You'd go maybe get 2 or 3 or 4 delegates or 10 or 15 to join with you in that thing. It would go to the committee.
Okay.
And the committee would hold hearings just like the legislature.
And so I could come in and I could explain to the committee why I thought it was a good idea.
Right. Other
people might come in and say, well, had you thought about this, and maybe we should do it this way and so forth, and that would be a part of their process of hammering out that part of the Constitution.
Absolutely. It worked almost the same way as the legislature, except that all committees were open to the media and to the public, and there was an effort made to allow, through the media, adequate notice of a hearing, so that you didn't have an issue today and have a hearing at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning that nobody had any notice of. That there had to be something like a 3-day thing. I don't recall right now, but
that would be typical too of how the legislative rules work.
Well, now,
I see.
But Bob,
okay,
legislature changed its rules substantially after the new Constitution came, and after the rules that they had seen had been successful for the convention.
So essentially your rules affected the legislature in sessions following the CONCON, sounds like.
Yes, I'm sure they did.
Yeah, well, I think so. Now, you know, we've talked about the fact that incumbent legislators were barred from running for the Constitutional Convention, mm-hmm. but the process was open. So were there legislators then that came to the CONCON and presented testimony before your committees?
Oh, I'm sure there were. Many of them were there. I didn't have the opportunity because of the rules thing and being a floor manager. And on the Bill and Rights Committee, which is a heavy, heavy, heavy loaded committee, to observe other committee activities and what kind of hearings they had or who participated in them. The recollection that I do have is that when I was in the legislature and ran for Attorney General, I became well acquainted with those who ran the various organizations in Montana of the conservative bent, and knew who the lobbyists for those groups were, as well as the other side too. And I noticed that the business corporate world was not participating early in the Constitutional Convention. Now you remember, they'd lost the vote to have the convention. Then they won the vote to keep those who spearheaded the convention out as delegates. Now there appeared to me and to others, particularly the Marion Erdman, the former mayor of Great Falls, who was quite a political influence in eastern Montana.
And a Republican.
That for some reason these people weren't participating. So we concluded that maybe that lack of participation was because if they didn't have their influence here to keep that both sides a balanced input to the delegates, that it would tend to be more liberal than conservative, and as a result of that would be more easily defeated and the people wouldn't accept it. So Marion and I went in and talked to Leo Graybill and presented our case to him and said, "Now, you know, we know these people, they're not here." And he got to checking out it independently and they weren't, and called us back together and said, "Well, you must have a proposal to resolve this." And I said, "Yeah, I want to write them a letter. I know who they are." Marion and I went around and gathered up who they were and wrote all of them a personal letter and invited them to participate and said, "You know, your failure to participate is going to be something that we're going to have to remark to the media about if you don't."
Because it was essentially like the business community was effectively boycotting, or at least not maybe boycotting, but just not participating.
My personal opinion, the dean of the business community lobbyist and the man with that sphere of influence, particularly with Bob Corrett, lobbyist for the Montana Power Company, and he was such a major player under the old Constitution that he really wanted, even if we drafted a new Constitution, if it wasn't adopted, the old one was still in place.
Sure.
Because when the new came in, if it did come in, it repealed the old. That's just the way you do that. And he just wanted to take one more shot at it.
And so your feeling was that perhaps Bob Corrett might have used his influence in various ways to kind of discourage the business community from cooperating
through the chamber, and his relationship with the stock growers and various others who had sort of been in the conservative group, and, you know, from that side of the political agenda, which is my side,
yeah,
basically, from a conservative nature. I personally believe, I still do, I'll probably go to my grave believing it, that there was a movement to allow us to become so populist and liberal in what we did that the citizens of Montana in their adoption election would fail to adopt the Constitution, which had happened in other states.
In fact,
I don't know, I think maybe Hawaii before us 10 or 15 or 20 years earlier was the last one to adopt a new state Constitution. I don't know of any passed since.
Yeah.
So
I think Montana's maybe the most modern constitution today.
I think it is.
Yeah,
I think.
And
it has
the reputation, I think, perhaps for being the most progressive, if that's the right term, or I'm not sure that liberal is quite the right term, but at least a very progressive constitution when compared to the other states. In part, I suppose, because it is the newest one. But do you think that might also have something to do with the fact that the business community in Montana didn't show up?
Well, I. Yes, they didn't. They want one more shot at. You keep the old Constitution in place if you don't adopt a new.
Sure.
Regardless of whether we drafted it.
Yeah.
So they did. Well, they did show up after the letter got out, but their role was a token role.
Do you think if they had taken a very hands-on, participatory, active interest in the Constitutional Convention, that the document might have been some different than it is?
You know, we adopted annual conventions, annual sessions of the legislature. I don't think that that would have occurred if there had been some influence there. I think the judicial article might have been a little bit different had they participated.
Clean and healthful environment, maybe?
I don't know that that would have. There may have been some things in the quality environment and quality education things that might have. You know, Bob, I don't know that effectively they would have had anything different in substance, but those people were so skilled in their legislative abilities that maybe the language would have been better, would have lent to a little more, would have given a judicial review a better opportunity to define what it is without so much trouble in some areas. They've had a great deal of difficulty, for instance, right now over the quality education thing.
The quality education provision in the state constitution.
Right. It's vague. I mean, it's wonderful that it's there, but it's so vague it's been abused.
Yeah.
And then what happened, really, if you have, and the Constitution itself is not the problem. My opinion of the problem with the Constitution is that same business community, I get ahead of my game a little bit. So they came and played a token role, and we had drafted a constitution. Then they had the election. Now that same group who opposed the commission in the beginning and who didn't want to show up at the convention, hoping it would be something that people wouldn't adopt, now tried to get the people to refuse to adopt the convention. And they lost. And it was a tough thing. But part of the impetus of the people of the convention to lead the state of Montana and the people of Montana to adopt the convention was their unhappiness with that group participating. There was some of that. I don't know what it was, but it probably was enough to have adopted the Constitution. It was probably enough to have spurred a whole bunch of delegates to work harder toward the adoption than they might have otherwise. Because ordinarily you go home and let somebody else do it. But the delegates played in it. They led the battle.
And you had conservatives such as yourself and many other. Betty Babcock, of course, is a card-carrying conservative, the wife of former Governor Tim Babcock. And, I can think of...
Jim Garlington,
attorney for Missoula.
A dozen people that wrote
really hard. Wrote from here in the Flathead Valley.
Absolutely.
Who were card-carrying conservatives, and they joined you in supporting the...
Dave Drum from Billings got a ton of money helping.
Yeah.
You know, it was a... you know... Their movement backfired against them. Then they brought litigation to challenge the election. And lost that.
Yeah, in the Supreme Court.
So my observation, and I didn't serve in the next legislative sessions, although in retrospect, I guess I was naive enough to not fully understand the importance of implementation of those provisions of the Constitution that aren't self-executing. But the Democrats didn't miss that because Leo was there. And Leo knew the significance of implementing various parts of the new Constitution, because the old had been repealed.
Yeah.
All those restrictions were gone. Now, you had to spell out what had to be done under the Constitution by the legislature in the statutes of Montana in many instances. And because that group had sort of had its nose blunted in all of this constitutional thing, as you recall, the Democrats controlled the next few sessions of the legislature when most of that implementation was passed. And I think if anything is liberal, that was the time things became liberal.
I see. What does the term self-executing mean? I think I know, but...
That means the provision of the Constitution itself doesn't require statutory embellishment in order to understand what it is.
But most of the Constitution does.
Right.
And so there was a whole lot, I remember when I was in the legislature, a whole raft of legislation that came in to implement the Constitution. I probably carried some of it myself. Mm-hmm. And that most of the Constitution required that, but some of it was self-executing.
Right.
I see.
Lots of the sections of the Bill of Rights didn't require, they were just self-executed.
Now, I would think what that would have been a really wonderful experience to have been part of something like that, to have been, you know, part of the group that rewrote the Constitution of the State of Montana. Looking back on that, I'm sure that had to be one of the great experiences of your life. And I know that the CONCON delegates get together from time to time, don't they, and have reunions? And
just like those from 1898 or whatever it was, in that first Constitutional Convention, those delegates had formed a society called the Constitutional Convention Society. And we found publications on that. We found minutes someplace. Somebody did. I don't know where they came from. Probably the Historical Society or somebody. They met until they were down to, only two or three survived annually.
Yeah.
And we have done exactly the same thing.
And it's been, nearly 30 years? Or more than 30 years?
30
years,
well, 72.
72 to 2005.
33 years.
33
yeah.
years. And you still have, an annual meeting?
Yes.
You get together?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's got to be a...
Well, it's an interesting thing.
Yeah.
Because the implementation was so successful in the liberal Democrat vein versus the Republican, those particular delegates have more interest in meeting annually than more than the conservatives do for some reason. I don't know why, but they do. They sort of lead that thing. Some of us participate infrequently.
Marshall, we've just got maybe not even a minute left. Were there any Constitutional Convention delegates that actively opposed ratification? I think all of the delegates signed the Constitution.
I believe all of them signed it, but there were a few, and I don't recall who they were, Bob, that did oppose it, that just couldn't buy it when they got back home and talked to the people about it.
I see.
During the latter days of the convention, there became a group of about 24, and we called them the Cowboys. 24, and I'm not sure they were all Republicans. 24 people in the ranching agricultural world who formed a kind of anti-liberal bloc and voted sort of as a unit, and they were opposing lots of things. Now, but I think when we got the document finalized out of the style committee and adopted the whole document in the form that it was ultimately came out, that most of those, if not all of them, signed it.
I see.
But I think some of them went home and opposed it.
And they would have probably been in that rural group for the most part.
I think so.
Cowboy group.
I think so.
Anything to say in conclusion?
Well, I've had a short but wonderful political career. But that isn't all that I've done, too. You know, I've done lots of other things. I gave you a copy of my resume, and if you read it, you know that if public service in various areas is fun, I've had more fun than anybody know.
You've devoted a lot of your life to public service.
And I've enjoyed every bit of it.
Greatly appreciated. Thank you, Marshall.